Amber, you probably want to reiterate that we're recording.
I will do that. Thank you.
It looks like if you take a good breath, it shows you it's speaking.
Yes, we can hear you breathing, Jane. We are going to begin in just a minute, everyone who has joined. Thank you for your patience. Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for joining us. Welcome to the public webinar on the study that's been called for by Senate Bill 4 related to well stimulation technologies such as hydraulic fracturing in California. Again, thank you for joining us today. I am Amber Mace. I am the Deputy Director of the California Council on Science and Technology. I am going to start by providing an overview of the process. And then I will turn it over to the chair of the steering committee, Dr. Jane Long, who will walk you through the study topics and some results from the previous study. And then we will take clarifying questions in writing. And as a reminder, we are recording this presentation and we will post it on the California Council on Science and Technology website. Next slide, please. Our purpose today is to share with you the process we're using to conduct this study, the timeline for the study, and what the study will cover. Next slide. As time permits, we will have an opportunity for you to ask questions at the end of the presentation, and we ask that you submit your questions in writing. Please write any questions into the chat function of the webinar program. Next question, please. If you have any questions or technical difficulties about this, either through writing your questions in or connecting or hearing, please call Hillary at the number listed there. That's 916-492-0996. Next slide, please. Let me start by telling you a little bit about the California Council on Science and Technology, or CCST. CCST is a nonpartisan, nonprofit. It was established in 1988 by the California legislature in recognition of the need for an independent source of science and technology advice to inform decision making. In recent years, CCST has produced a series of reports on innovation, water, energy, and STEM education in California. and our role is to oversee a very rigorous process. This involves convening the most relevant experts to put together a robust and balanced team, addressing any potential conflict of interest issues, and conducting an extensive and rigorous peer review. And we do all of this to ensure that all of the knowledge and expertise that we pull together is delivered in a product that is both useful to decision makers and has the credibility and integrity necessary when addressing a complex and high-profile issue like the one we're talking about today. Next slide, please. So we are conducting the study in partnership with a number of expert partners, including the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory. And the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory is well known for conducting research relevant to the public, particularly on this topic. And I'll tell you a little bit more about them in just a moment. Their subcontractors, our subcontractors on this project in partnership with Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory are the Pacific Institute, Physicians, Scientists, and Engineers for Healthy Energy, Stanford University, Dan Gauthier, Scripps Institution of Oceanography, and the California State University Stanislaus Endangered Species Recovery Program. Next slide, please. Here's a little bit more information about Lawrence Berkeley National Lab, who is conducting the bulk of the analyses associated with this project. And they have they are a Department of Energy National Lab and, again, are well known for this type of work. Next slide, please. The steering committee is a very important aspect of the study, and it's critical for the success of the study to convene a steering committee that is represents both the appropriate range of expertise for the task, has a balance of perspectives, and are screened for conflicts of interest. CCST takes this very seriously and has modeled our approach based on the National Academy of Sciences, and we have worked carefully to nominate, identify, select, review, and put together a team of experts who will be able to contribute in a balanced way to the entire report process. And next slide, please. With that, I will turn it over to Jane to tell you a little bit about the study topics and previous results.
Thanks, thanks, Amber. So this steering committee, in conjunction with our subcontractors and, of course, Lawrence Berkeley National Lab, have been working together for a little bit more time than what we've been working on SB4 reports. We were also contracted by the Bureau of Land Management to do a very similar report, and the outcome of that report does form the basis of what we are going to explain to you today. Both of these reports are based on peer-reviewed published literature, available public data. For example, Frac Focus data is included, relevant publications, reports, theses. We are careful, though, not to include anything that would just be, for example, news reports or advocacy information. We use the steering committee extensively to, and the expertise of this committee, which is scientific experts and balanced from various points of view, to identify issues and to help direct the evaluations. And we also have solicited nominations of information for the public, and those all of those periodicals and reports are available for public scrutiny if you so desire. The study is going to be produced in three volumes. The first volume will be delivered on January 1st, and at some time after that will be made public. It is going to be on well stimulation technologies and their past, present, and potential future use in California. The second volume will look at environmental impacts and of the stimulation treatments. And the third volume will be a set of case studies where we will look a little bit more closely at site-specific or geographically specific issues and risks. And both these second two volumes will be delivered on July 1st of 2015. The prior study for BLM is very important to this study because it was a very quick study. It was done in just a few months, and without benefit of the SB4 required reporting, having gone for very long. It was only a few months of data, but it was very important for identifying issues that are now being looked at in more detail in the SB4 study. The BLM study looked at three key questions: what was the past, current, future practice in oil well stimulation technologies? And those three technologies are the same three technologies specified in SB4: hydraulic fracturing, acid fracturing, and matrix acidizing. And then they were very interested in where the technologies might allow expanded production constrained to onshore oil, both all of this constrained to onshore oil in California, and then a fairly extensive chapter on the potential environmental hazards. That report is available at the web address shown there on our website, and it was released in August and at the end of August, and has now been is now public. Besides the BLM report and the literature, we had a hands-on trip down to the San Joaquin Valley, which is where almost all the hydraulic fracturing and well stimulation technology takes place in the state. And we had 2 days of visiting down there, first day hosted by companies and the second day hosted by community organizers and environmental action type people that were activists for environmental issues and environmental justice issues. And that field trip informed quite a bit of our understanding of what's going on down there and is going to be very useful in understanding how to what particularly in the case study evaluation of volume 3. So now I'm going to talk to you a little bit about the first volume. There are four chapters. Volume 1 is currently in the review process. The review process is very extensive. We have a number of reviewers who are anonymous and provide a detailed review of these chapters, and then the authors respond to this review, and their response is then overseen by two people who are report monitors, and they get back. They act like editors of a journal and determine whether the authors have been responsive to the review. That process is nearing its final phase. The report has been sent to the with the response to review has been sent to the review monitors. When it returns, if there are any further changes, we'll make them, and then it will go to text editing, et cetera, and will be available. Will be delivered on January 1st. Now, this particular volume has a lot of overlap with the BLM study, so I'm going to talk a little bit about the relevant results from the BLM study now. So this is results from the previous study. So the first thing that we did was look at just what exactly these technologies are like, and this is an example of hydraulic fracturing, but we looked at matrix acidation and also acid fracturing. This particular outline shows a little bit about how a hydraulic fracture takes place. And here you see a borehole, a sketch of a borehole, and what happens is that you seal off a section of that borehole to treat, a treatment zone, and then you pump fluid into that zone at a high enough pressure to break the rock. And the rock breaks according to the state of stress in the rock, in other words, where the strongest pressures are from the rock weight or tectonic stresses and also the fabric of the rock will determine the orientation of the fracture. But the amount of fluid that you put in and the type of fluid has something to do with the size of the fracture and the number of fractures that you get. So what we found was that in California, they tend to use a fracturing fluid, which is a high viscosity, in other words, very thick, like a thick fluid, viscous fluid. And in other states that where fracking has hydraulic fracturing has been used more extensively, we found that they used something called slick water, which is a low viscosity fluid. So high gels are using things like guar gum to make the fluid thick, and lower viscosity fluids would be using some kind of a detergent or soap to make it make slippery water. And in other states, the volume used is very large because they want to open up a whole network of fractures like the picture on the right. But in California, the rocks tend to be a little bit more permeable, and there tends to be a little bit more of an existing fracture network in the rock. So the goal is simply to put a single big fracture there that will collect oil from the existing or natural fracture system. So we tend to use gel. Normally in other places they use a lot more slick water. As well, in other states, it looks more, the hydraulic fracturing that's going on looks more like what's on the left, where they go down to some depth and hit a pay zone, which is horizontally extensive, drill a very long reach horizontal well, and do a lot of treatments all along that horizontal section, which can be miles long. In California, the wells tend to be fairly shallow and vertical, and so the hydraulic fracturing that's going on doesn't have to fill that whole borehole with fluid, and as a result, it uses a lot less water for that reason, too. Shallow fracking is hydraulic fracturing is much more common in California. There are very few of these long-reach wells that have been fractured in California, large-reach horizontal wells. So we see differences in the geology, and therefore there are differences in the production practice. And California, again, to reiterate, has shallower, more vertical wells, and the concentration of the chemicals in the fluid can be higher, but it tends to be gel and not slick water, and we consequently don't use as much water per operation in California as these other states. Next question was where the technologies might expand, and here we looked at where it's happening now, and this is a map of where of the fields that have been hydraulically fractured. But what we find is that about 98% of those occur in the San Joaquin Valley, and this is according to Frac Focus and Dogger's records. And in fact, 85% of the hydraulic fracturing is occurring in four fields, in just four fields on the west side of the San Joaquin. So Elk Hills, Lost Hills, North Bell Ridge really account for almost all the hydraulic fracturing in the state. Very, very little in the Los Angeles Basin or anywhere else. So we also looked at where things might happen in the future, and we have a USGS study looking at where how much oil is remaining in and around the giant fields that are already in production, shown here in this map on the right. And we found that about 15 billion barrels of, up to 15 billion barrels of oil remains in 19 giant fields of the San Joaquin and L.A. Basin, and those are shown on the right here in the green outlined in right. So there's quite a bit of oil remaining in and around these existing fields, and we know how to produce that. So the likely scenario for the future production is that it would take place in and around future fields, and as some of those are, especially those in the San Joaquin Valley, are currently undergoing hydraulic fracturing to be produced, we think that's the most likely place it would happen in the future. But of course, the thing that started a lot of concern about hydraulic fracturing in California was estimates of what was happening in the what could be happening in the Monterey Formation, shown here in the dark green. And the Monterey Formation is the source rock for all of these, for a lot of these reservoirs that have migrated oil. So the oil is formed at depth of these very deep rocks that contain a lot of carbon, and then they experience high pressures and temperatures such that oil forms, and then the oil moves out, migrates near the surface where it's trapped, and that's where all of the pretty much all of the production in California takes place right now. So the question is, in these source rocks that are very deep, does there remain oil, and is there a lot of oil, and does it remain there, and can it be produced? So the colors orange and magenta there are where the Monterey Formation is in the oil window. In other words, that's that part of the Monterey Formation where there could be oil in the source rocks, and those should be the source of all those gray-hatched oil reservoirs that are now in production. And so the EIA estimated that this resource could be enormous in 2011, and you see on the left the pie chart showing that they said there were 15 billion barrels possibly of production, dwarfing what's going on in the Bakken or the Eagle Ford down in the east. And in 2014, after talking to actually some of our committee members, they revised their estimate to 0.6 billion barrels, where now they think that the Eagle Ford and the Austin Chalk and the Bota will account for the vast majority of oil shale source rock recovery in the United States. Our conclusion here is that both of these estimates are highly uncertain. We don't think that we have a very good idea about what's coming out of the Monterey, and there's no reports of successful production from these deep source rocks to date. So our sense is that we're a long way from knowing how much oil could be coming out of the source rocks, similar to, in some ways, to these massive new plays that have been found in places like the Eagle Ford and the Bakken. Coming now in Volume 1, which will again will be produced January 1, is we'll be going a bit deeper into the results that you just saw, but also we will include offshore practice, the well stimulation technology used in gas production, new data on acid use. You might have noted that we had few results on acid use in California because at that time we found no data that would support any significant acid use in the database that was available to us. Since that time, we have found information on acid use, and so there will be quite a bit more on acid. There's also a longer record from Dogger and Frac Focus, and that will be extremely helpful in understanding the trends. And then the deeper analysis of the geologic potential will also show up. So you'll see that coming out early next year. Volume 2 is about the potential impacts, and on the left you see the list of impacts that we're going to look at, similar to the ones that we looked at for the BLM, with a probably a little bit more on human health than we and traffic noise and light than we had before, and more on ecological impacts. As well, there's going to be some kind of a qualitative hazard analysis, and we are going to not only look at what we know, which is going to have two parts, really, things that we have actually been observed and measured in California, and where that hasn't, where we're not, where we don't have that kind of information, are we able to extrapolate from experience elsewhere? For example, if we know something about air emissions in another state and we know the difference between the practice in the other state or the regulatory environment in the other state and California, we may be able to make some evaluation of what is happening in California, even though California hasn't had direct observation. We're also going to look at alternative practices that would ameliorate or remove or address impacts, and we'll also be evaluating the data gaps that exist in the state, which are fairly significant. For example, you know, on the water impacts, we have not found evidence of water contamination, but we also know that there are few, if any, studies that have actually looked for water contamination from a hydraulic fracturing. So those kinds of issues will be highlighted. And then, again, we had some evaluation of some of these issues from the BLM study, and I'll give you some of these results now. First of all, the toxicity of the frac fluid is a very interesting issue because there are a great number of chemicals that can be used. Fundamentally, as I mentioned earlier, we're looking at additives to the water which change its viscosity, either make it thick and gel-like or make it slick water. But as well, many other kinds of chemicals are added, including some of the more toxic things are biocides and corrosion inhibitors. But and this little pie chart shows a graph of the chemicals that showed up more than 2% of the time in the data in California, and shows them on, ranked or classified by their standardized toxicity rating. So you see about 1% of the chemicals actually have the highest, toxicity rating. None show up as the most toxic. And quite a few of them are not very toxic at all, and about a third of them don't have any data. This is what's called acute mammalian toxicity, which means that you essentially feed that chemical to an animal, usually a mouse or a rabbit, and you determine how much it takes to kill that animal. This is not the only kind of toxicity that's important. The other kinds of toxicity have to do with chronic toxicity and bioaccumulation of these chemicals, and we didn't have very much data on that at all. So this gets to the heart of, I think, some of the things that the public are concerned about, and there's going to be quite a bit more work on this in volume two coming out. So I think I talked through all that on that previous slide, so I'll move on. So the next thing is how much fracturing is actually happening, and you see here the data that we had available at the time, where the green is data that occurs both in Frac Focus, a voluntary database, which is not necessarily verified by anyone, Dogger data, which is required reporting, and you'll see that the green is data that occurs in both Frac Focus and in Dogger's files, and that there's some things that occur in Dogger's files and not Frac Focus, and the other way around. So that's one issue that we see. You see this immediate up bump in reporting that occurred when Dogger requested operators to start reporting in 2012, and then several other means where we've looked at calibrating all of this data, we think that there's something on the order of 100 to 150 hydraulic fracturing operations per month. And that's about 4% of the total number that's going on nationally. So we have a very small percentage. We are the third largest oil producer in the country, but we only account for 4% of the hydraulic fracturing. The average water use is very much smaller than what's used in the Eagle Ford. But it's about 130 gallons per operation, and that means that there's an acre foot of water, about 500 acre feet of water used per year, which is about 500 households worth of water. That's this slide. So it's about 500 acre feet of water per year, and that means that's an acre foot is about what an average household uses. So California, again, has we consume about 130,000 to 200 gallons per well on average, 100 to 150 simulations per month, and about 450 to 1,200 acre feet of gallon of water totally. And this is not a huge amount of water as things go, but it is taking place in a state that has extreme drought right now, and so it's locally significant. Another issue that we came up with in this is looking at where the depth of the wells are that are being hydraulically fractured, and this is a histogram showing the depth of wells recorded in different ways, and the ones on the left, the more frequent wells, are very shallow, so most of the wells are less than 2,000 or 3,000 feet deep. And what we see is that fracturing is occurring. These are wells that have been hydraulic fracturing, that a lot of hydraulic fracturing is taking place in wells that are less than 2,000 feet deep. This is quite different than what's happening in most of the other places where they're using long-reach horizontal wells, because those are going down a mile or so, and then they do the horizontal well and frack from there, so that hydraulic fracturing has a very, very poor chance of having the fracture intersect a usable groundwater aquifer closer to the surface. But in California, these hydraulic fractures are taking place quite shallow wells. It's not necessarily a problem, but we don't really know. And because what you're seeing here in the darker colors is where the hydraulic fracturing is going, but we just don't know enough about what the overlying groundwater is like. And the light pink here is where the total dissolved solids is less than 1,500, and the dark is where the fracturing is going on. But you can see we don't have very much data about the quality of the groundwater. We do know now that in some of these cases, the hydraulic fracturing plans, which now are required to file groundwater monitoring plans, we're finding that the Regional Water Quality Board is saying there is no usable groundwater. In other words, the groundwater is highly saline, and so there's nothing that they need to monitor. But we don't have a comprehensive view of what's going on with the groundwater quality near and around around the hydraulic fracturing sites. And what needs to be protected is also a little bit confusing because there are a lot of different standards, and we probably need to do some work to decide what level is appropriate now that increasingly saline water is increasingly of value because it can be either desalinated or mixed with other water for agriculture. What we are finding also is that when the frac fluids are injected in the well, they are subsequently produced, and California produces a lot of water out of these wells, so you first get a very high concentration of the frac fluids coming back out, and then you get a lower and lower concentration, but the frac fluids remain in the formation, and they react with the formation, so you have this fairly complicated chemistry that can tail off over time. And we have seen cases now where the produced water is used for irrigation, and it's not clear that the management of that water is taking into account whether or not the wells that are now being produced were hydraulically fractured and whether or not they still have any of the frac fluids in them. So this issue is one that we're looking into in much more depth now for us before. Again, something that may not be a problem or may be a problem, but we couldn't determine that practice was protective of agricultural water to be sure that frac chemicals were not getting into agricultural water. We really think that it's important that California do more work to understand where its groundwater is and to make some publicly available data about the location and quality of this groundwater. On the seismicity issue, we first looked at hydraulic fracturing as a seismic hazard and found that each hydraulic fracture is in fact a very, very small earthquake, if you like, but it's not a nuisance earthquake. It's not something that could be felt usually. And so what is more important is the actual disposal of water, which may contain frac fluids. And here where you're pumping fluid underground for a longer period of time, larger volumes, this can cause a more significant perturbation in the state of stress and has been known to cause seismicity. So the difficulty we're having in California is on the upper left here is the recorded earthquakes around the San Joaquin Valley, and on the lower right is the location of these injection wells, which we do think are potentially have a much higher likelihood of causing seismicity than the actual hydraulic fracturing themselves. But you can see that it's very hard to discern any pattern in a state where there are a plethora of earthquake events all the time. However, in the volume two of the SB4 report, we will try to see if we can find any correlations. It's probably going to be extremely difficult, but we're going to look. I talked about this. Yes, one point to make is that there was only one minor anomalous earthquake has been linked to hydraulic fracturing, and that was in 1991. So after thousands of hydraulic fractures, one has caused a very, very minor earthquake. So I think the final conclusion of this report, or one of the final ones, was that of the BLM report, was that the direct impacts of the actual act of doing a simulation are very, very small compared to the impacts of the entire production activity, which may, and to the extent that it's facilitated by hydraulic fracturing, it's the production itself which has the major impacts. That the amount of water, the seismicity, all of these things are much more significant for the entirety of the production activity rather than the specific small simulation events. So coming in Volume 2 will be a deeper analysis of the water disposition and air emissions, seismic correlation study. There will be more on ecological impact and more on human health hazard assessment, particularly proximity to these stimulation events. Also, I should say there will be more on acid impacts, because we had no particular data on the on acid stimulation for the BLM study. The final volume of this will be case studies. We're looking at trying to get four case studies done. These have two characteristics. One is they're geographically located, focused, and they're also issue-focused in that environment. So for the Los Angeles Basin, the development of the city and the development of oil production have been concurrent right from the beginning. People from that area, if you've driven through, you see the oil wells right in the middle of the city all over the place. And so that looks like the acid use will be the major well simulation that we'll be looking at. And as well, we're going to take a look at the source rocks underlying the L.A. Basin and just try to draw a comparison of what it would take to produce the oil remaining in existing migrated oil reservoirs versus getting after this very deep shale oil that may or may not be there. In the San Joaquin, we're very interested in what's happening with the water and to the extent that it contains fracking fluids. There may be other issues we're trying to uncover. For example, there may be some proximity issues these activities to schools and communities that we're going to look at. We're going to look a little bit at what the future might look like as a projection of the present, because we think it's very likely that more hydraulic fracturing would occur there because of the existence of reservoirs that look a lot like the ones that are currently being fracked. And we'll have a case study which will go after this Monterey question, the Monterey source rock question. We'll look in some detail at the geography of the parts of the Monterey that are in the shale oil window and try to understand if there's specific potential impacts in those in that geography that would be of potential concern. And we're also going to try to evaluate what it would take to go from where we are now and understanding the potential of the Monterey to having a reasonable estimate. We think that the current estimates are so poorly constrained that they're not very useful at all. So how would you get to the place where you had a useful estimate of the potential of the Monterey? We won't be able to make that estimate. Obviously, that would take a lot of time and money and boreholes and geophysics, et cetera, but we're going to describe what you would have to do. And finally, we're going to look a little bit more closely at the offshore production and just try to do a good job of evaluating what it is we know about what's happening offshore. So with that, I would be happy to take your questions. And again, here's how to participate.
Jane, actually, we're going to do this in writing, so if you want to just go back to the agenda slide. This is a reminder to everyone. Thank you for those who have already written in questions using your chat function. Please write in any questions that you have, and we will address them as possible. As a reminder, we are recording this presentation. So I
have one question here on the chat window. Is that where I should look?
I can read them to you, Jane, or you can take them from the chat window. We have three in there already.
Okay, I only see, oh, I see, okay, let me scroll here. So from Mike Thornton, Dogger data is incomplete and Frac Focus is a voluntary industry-sponsored website. What other data sources are you using to ensure the study is fully informed by using accurate and complete data? Well, you know, I think fundamentally the data is not going to be either completely accurate or complete, and that's just a fact of life. We're going to be trying to understand inconsistencies and gaps in the data, and we have qualified our report in terms of trying to understand trying to make it clear that it's based on voluntary data, and that voluntary data is not required to be either complete or accurate, nor is it verified. So if we didn't use it, we wouldn't have very much at all to talk about, but I think it's important that the public understand that the data is not complete or accurate or completely accurate. Where we see inconsistencies between the data, we are going to try to point it out. And other data sources that we're using, in some cases we found that the air quality boards keep data. The South Coast Board has kept very good data on acid use that wasn't available to us otherwise. During the field trip that we took, we made some inquiries with companies and telling them what was on the official record about what they were doing with produced water. And they told us that wasn't what they were doing with produced water, and we've asked them to give us a statement about what they're doing. And then our job will be to show that the official data and the industry claims are different. So I think the important thing for us to do is to try to make it really clear where the state needs more data. I have a second question here from again, I think I've answered your second question. And from Paul Dero, will the study look at all impacts from all oil extraction in California or just focus on the impacts of well stimulation? So this is a difficult problem because we're not going to look at all production, that's clear. But if that production is enabled by well stimulation, then we will go beyond looking at the impacts of just the well stimulation. So let me give you an example. Produced water is not due to the well stimulation. California produces more water in an oil well, vastly more water than oil. But if those wells are produced because they've been hydraulically fractured, then that produced water becomes part of our study. But the study scope does not include the impacts of all oil production in California, which is something that's a valid thing to do, but it's not what we were asked to do. Let's see, I have next. Will the slides be available? Yes, they're going to be posted, and the recording is posted on our website. Miriam Rotkin-Ellman, will the human health assessment include pre-existing environmental conditions? I don't know how to answer that question. I'm sorry. If you can elaborate, I will try to answer, but I don't know how to answer that. And the second question, will there be an assessment of the toxicity of flowback water in addition to fracking fluids? Well, to the extent that we can get the chemistry of flowback water, we'll probably be able to do it. But I don't think there have been very many analyses of flowback water. Remember that when you put these chemicals underground, they mix with the geologic formation and they react. So what comes back in the flowback water is not exactly what you put down. And that is a difficult problem. So we will do whatever we can, and we have some understanding of flowback water chemistry from other states, but I don't think there have been a lot of measurements in California. Gary Latsar, are you considering natural gas leakage after extraction? Several studies are showing substantial pipeline leakage. Pipeline leakage is not part of our study. It's beyond our scope. Bill, the map of the Monterey Shale shows far less of the formation than Dr. Baer, CSU Long Beach, does in his maps. Have you determined that aspects of the Monterey formation in Northern California or east of the Sierra are not oil-bearing? I am not aware of that discrepancy. The work on identifying the oil window parts of the Monterey Formation is being done by Don Gauthier and Pat Dobson at LBL. Don Gauthier did some of the original work at USGS. He's retired and consulting for us right now. I can refer that question to them for an answer, but I don't know the answer. Will the human health assessment address combined exposures, air and pollution and noise? So, in other words, you want to know whether the convolution of air pollution and noise will be addressed? My guess is not, but I think it will depend a little bit on what is found in the literature. There's now some significant amount of literature on noise and air pollution impacts. And so if it is in the literature and we find any data that looks at that, we will report it. So will the health assessment be peer-reviewed by California EPA or DPH? So the peer review will be by peer-reviewed experts. We are working with AWEA, this is the Office of Health and Environmental. I'm sorry to say I cannot tell you exactly what it stands for, but it's the part of the Cal EPA that looks at toxic substances and the risks impacts. And they are, by statute, they were part of this study, and we're working very closely with them, and they're helping us with the toxicity. The peer reviewers are chosen by nomination based on expertise. So I think that is a separate process.
That's the Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment.
Thank you. Will the steering committee be holding a series of focus groups with the public for input on Volume 3 case studies? No, we will not, but the AWEA is going to hold a World Cafe type model, and we will participate in that, and it will be the results of that will inform what we do in the case studies. The field trip that we took also informed the case studies, and I think I would refer you to AWEA for their schedule on how they're going to go ahead with that. But we'll be using they will conduct the some public meeting, and we will be part of it. Bill Aliad, average of 133 gallons of water per well. Where is this number derived for? We are seeing wells in the Shafter area averaging over 500, and even in the Belridge, often higher than 1,000. So I think that basically there's a spectrum, and certainly there are wells that are over 500,000. I think there's actually been a multi-million gallon frack or two. But we just did a statistical analysis of the data available, and that's an average per operation. GHSO, it's a global, I think it stands for Global Health Standard, but it's a it is, I'm sorry to say, Charo's on, and she, Charo, if you're on, could you Text me, please, what GHS stands for. I can't remember. It's a global standardized toxicity measurement. And Cheryl is also one of our investigators, and she's confirming we don't have much information about the chemistry of flowback water for the person who asked about that.
It stands for globally harmonized system. Thanks,
yeah,
Charu.
Thank you. Where are the deep wells being drilled, and how does it relate to the state's geology? I think a couple of operators have drilled deep wells, and I don't know where they are. There aren't very many. There have been a few, and we're not privy to the outcome. The industry wouldn't reveal that, or doesn't have to reveal that. And then another question from clarification from Miriam Rock and Elman. To clarify the first question, I'm asking whether the health assessment will look at the incremental addition of contaminants on top of existing air pollution, air and water pollution. I don't know exactly how they're going to do that, but I think they have to have something. We will be calibrating and comparing. For example, if you look at criteria pollutants that are emitted, we will be looking at that in the context of the total amount that's emitted from other sources. So I think the answer is yes. I have no more questions here.
Okay, so unless anyone has any other questions that they'd like to submit in writing, we thank you for your participation today. And again, this webinar is being recorded. We will post it on our website, and we will make the slides available as well. It looks like we have one additional question.
So his first part says, our slide of a typical well outside California shows it very deep and then going horizontal versus a shallow well in California into a pocket of oil. This is inaccurate. The slide was for enhanced oil recovery, not fracking. That slide was for enhanced oil recovery. Okay, I don't see a question there, but we're just trying to illustrate that the wells in California tend to be shorter and vertical, whereas the wells that have sparked the hydraulic fracturing revolution tend to be long reach horizontal wells. Andrew Grinberg, will the study look at underground injection into Class II wells that have been the subject of increased scrutiny for injection into non-exempt aquifers? Was any of the waste injected there the result of stimulated wells? Well, your last question is exactly what we're going to be looking at, is whether or not any of that has involved stimulated wells. We go deep in horizontal too, yes, but the vast majority of our hydraulically fractured wells are vertical and short. Okay, so Bill, please write us an email about what you don't like about that slide, and we'll be happy to try to understand your point about how to make it more accurate. So from Marion Rock and Ellen again, will the health assessment take into account the increased susceptibility of vulnerable populations? I believe it will. Any other clarifying questions? Okay.
All right. Well, again, thank you all for joining us, and thank you, Jane. And we will make this information available on the website, and be happy to answer any other clarifying questions. And thanks for joining. If you have any other questions, please let us know, and we look forward to our next presentation. Have a good day.
would have